Accession number 30249, Reel 7.
Gordon Noshua, Reel 7. The refugees, this reminds me, you were in a very different culture there, weren't you?
Yes, yeah.
Was this stimulating?
Yes, it was. I mean, visually, it was amazing. I mean, the Eritreans, the women especially, dress beautifully. I mean, you can be in the middle of the desert with nothing for miles, and you'll come across a woman with a beautiful silk-looking dress, a shiny dress, beautiful bright greens and yellows and blues. And she'll be walking down the road with an oil drum on her head full of water, or if there's no oil drum, then she's carrying an umbrella to keep the sun off. And it was that the umbrellas impressed me most of all. I couldn't believe I'd see so many umbrellas in such a hot country. But of course they use them to keep the sun off. I naively thought they didn't need to keep the sun off, you know, but they do. And they all have these great big umbrellas, and you see them walking again in the desert or all on their own with a big umbrella. Quite extraordinary. But this search for water, I mean, the women obviously do all the water carrying, and they will walk 10 kilometres with a huge drum of water balanced on their heads. Quite extraordinary. They're carrying drums that are bigger than they are, and they're just balanced on their heads, and they just walk down these country roads with great poise. Quite extraordinary. That memory stays with me. Quite extraordinary. You know, they look quite wealthy when you see them, and then you find where they're living, and they're living in very poor accommodation. And as I say, that, you know, a lot of the refugees are under UN plastic sheets, and their possessions are minimal. I mean, they maybe have a cooking pot and a kettle and a fire, but precious little else. A few rugs, but other than that, just what they stand up in. You know, the man all seems to have an AK-47. Strangely enough, even the poorest carry their AK-47, you know, but that's, you see that everywhere, you know. But that amused me somewhat, really. They're so poverty stricken, but they can obviously afford ammunition, so. But they were only surviving because of the United Nations and the UN at that stage was shipping in huge convoys carrying, as far as I could see, mostly maize. I suppose that's probably one of their staples, really, in that area. And people would queue for hours in the sun waiting for the lorries to turn up. Each town had its marketplace, and everybody congregated there and just sat all day and waited for the delivery. Quite a sort of carnival atmosphere in a way. Obviously, you know, all these families are getting together for the one delivery of the week, you know. And they were very friendly, lovely people, quite happy to have their photographs taken. No problem at all with them.
Did you do any painting of the people?
Yes, I've done a series of refugees. Because they make such lovely subjects, you know, and in Ethiopia and Eritrea they have such poise. The people are very dignified, even when they have no homes, they still retain their dignity, and that was quite noticeable. Actually, don't see that everywhere.
They're the same people, basically, aren't they? The
basically, I think they must. Yes,
Ethiopian,
they look the same.
Do
yeah,
they?
Well,
they
do do to me. Yes, yeah. But well, it's the politicians again, isn't it? It's the presidents that cause the wars, you know. And they're vicious fighters. Both sides fight in a very, very hard way. Very aggressive people, you know. But but to socially, I mean, they're lovely. But
did you go to Addis Ababa?
No, no, I didn't get. We didn't get too far into Ethiopia, and so I felt the Ethiopians probably weren't really very welcoming. I think they felt the UN was on the side of the Eritreans, and that could well be true. I mean, it looked to me as though the Ethiopians were invading Eritrea rather than the other way round, you know. And the fact that the main UN bases were in Eritrea made me think that, the UN probably regarded the Ethiopians as the aggressors. They were certainly... they were quite difficult. They were certainly difficult. We crossed the border into Ethiopia to visit a Dutch base, and then tried to cross back over into Eritrea. And the vehicle I was in was just an open back vehicle. They were all Dutch except me, and all military except me. And because I wasn't military, and my passport was different to the Dutch, they had us sit in the sun for 3.5 hours while they decided whether they let me through back into Eritrea again. That was a bit worrying at the time. But my Dutch escorts said, just don't worry about it, you know. If the worst comes to the worst, we'll just make a run for it. But they were, yeah, the Ethiopians did play it a bit difficult and kept making numerous phone calls to high-ranking officials somewhere or other, because there was an Englishman there, you know, and he's not in uniform, and what's he doing there, you know?
Probably you would have been safer in a uniform.
Probably, yeah. Well, they wouldn't have even noticed me, you see.
You stuck out, I suppose.
Yeah. Yes, I did. Yeah, well, I was smaller than everybody else as well, so these are great Dutch lads, you know. But I mean, that's probably the last time I've been anywhere not in uniform, because I wear uniform all the time these days. And it's that, yes, a uniform certainly gets you in and out of places. If all your friends are dressed the same way, you can wander in and out without anybody knowing you're there, you know.
At this stage, you know, you've been to quite a few war zones. Mm. Were you getting sort of ginned up regarding insurance should anything happen to you? Or were any of these groups offering you insurance?
No, nobody has ever offered me insurance, as far as I can remember. And I've never been able to get insurance. That's virtually impossible for me to get insurance, because I'm generally going into I have to be honest with these people, I'm going into some highly dangerous places, and you can't. I mean, I journalists must get insurance, so they must know where to go. We've never been successful, and generally speaking, I've not worried too much about insurance. I hope to, I know. Mm-hmm. But
yes, I've been wondering about the army groups, you know, who take you. It's their, it would seem it was their responsibility.
I suppose ultimately it is. We just don't discuss it most of the time. I mean, I've been into Iraq, and had to sign a piece of paper to say that if anything happened to me, it was my fault, and I wasn't the responsibility of the Dutch government, you know.
And the same in Afghanistan, when you've been...
Well, we've never discussed it with Afghanistan, with the Brits, so just go and do it. Nothing's going to happen. You know, I'm being well looked after. I'd have to be very unlucky anyway, but that's a very foolish attitude. It doesn't worry me, to be honest. I'm not going to turn down a job just because I can't get insurance. It's quite simple. I know that's foolhardy, but my wife shrugs as well, so you know. She could always sell all the pile of paintings if anything goes wrong. It's not uppermost in my mind. I enjoy the job too much.
So how long were you there in Eritrea?
I was in Eritrea 2 weeks, I suppose.
And intensive again?
Yes, we were on the move all the time. Something fresh every day. And we didn't live rough. I mean, I lived in tented accommodation all the time. In a place like that, you wouldn't want to sleep out. You have to get into a fortified area at night. They looked after me superbly. It's just come to me, this Dutch humour thing. This Dutch major had been attached to the British Royal Marines, and they have an expression in the Marines that if you really like something, it's the dog's bollocks. That's the expression. Well, everywhere we went, every time I asked, can I photograph that view? Wow, look at that. Oh, got to have a photograph of that. Can I draw that? You know, my Dutch major friend, he said, the first time I did it, I sort of said, stop the Land Rover, I've got to get that. He said, Gordon, it is, as you say in England, it is the canine's testicles. I nearly fell out of the Land Rover. And after that, this went round, and I think every damn Dutch marine in Eritrea knew, you know, what to say. And whoever I was with, and wherever I was, whenever I sort of went, wow, you know, somebody'd say, ah. Very funny, very funny. Yes, they're good lads. They great, great sense of humour, you know.
So what did the Dutch want out of this from you?
They also wanted one large painting. They all seem to want one large painting. They all need a record of a deployment, you know.
And did you want to sort of fit everything in?
I had to do a great big montage with probably 10 different views. I've got visuals somewhere for it. And I showed, they desperately wanted to show the ladies with the umbrellas, you know, it made quite an impression on them as well, and the Canadian sort of input, and all sorts of aspects, the refugees and the patrolling and the helicopters and, you know, so I collected all these different images and wove it all together, you know, into a piece. But again, I did lots and lots of work for myself, and the Dutch Marines Museum bought a series from me when I got back. I showed them because I had access to all the orders groups and the armories, and I talked to the mechanics that were repairing the vehicles, and so I got. So, you know, all the logistics side and the planning side, you know, and of course I recorded it all, and their museum saw the value of this, you know. Again, it was the less than glamorous side that appealed to them, really, because again, you know, in years to come, people will look back and be able to see exactly what life was like and what the equipment was and what the vehicles were like, you know. So that's become quite a large part of their archive in Rotterdam.
And did you have an exhibition when you of your own?
Yeah, well, after this, the Dutch Marines decided that I should have an exhibition in Holland, so the Dutch Marines Museum had an exhibition of all my work up till that time in Rotterdam, and that was superb, and that was a great compliment. I was honoured to be asked, to show in a foreign country, so it was quite nice anyway, you know, and they treated me really well, and they paid for my wife and I to go over, and we went over for a week, and in fact, we took all the work with us, and then we spent a week hanging the exhibition, which is what I did. Shirley was off shopping and sightseeing, looking at windmills and things. But yeah, we hung this exhibition just how I wanted. You know, I had lots to say in the running order of the pictures and where they should go, etc.
That must be important with the sort of work you do.
Yeah.
The juxtaposition.
Yeah. Well, you want to tell a story, and you want to. There's got to be a logic to it, you know, so that it makes sense. I mean, my logic always is start at the beginning and work your way through. It seems, you know, fairly simple.
But then I suppose certain pictures relate to each other.
Yeah. I mean, you end up with groups, or campaigns, if you like, you know. But you end up with groups, and then you sometimes you've got link pieces, you know. But that was a fine exhibition. I loved it. We had a tremendous private view, where they made English tea at the private view, and they got a huge teapot, massive great teapot, and they cooked scones and all sorts of things. Oh dear, it was lovely. And then Dutch television interviewed me, and Dutch radio interviewed me, and they really pushed the boat out. It was tremendous. I got a lot more recognition there than ever I get in this country.
This issue of recognition, it seems a daft question. Is it important? But what it means to
I think it is important. You can slave away in your garret, you know, but people need to know you're there. People need to see what you've done, you know. The work's got to go out there for people to look at. I'm painting it for pleasure, I'm painting it for a living, but I'm also painting it for other people to see. So you need coverage. I mean, I've been lucky in the last 2 years, things have really started to happen. Hampshire County Council suddenly realised that I was here and doing things, and offered me a travelling exhibition, and we had 18 months of a travelling war show, which travelled round all the county council museums and galleries in Hampshire, and that was a huge success. The public, turned out in droves to see it, I was getting letters and phone calls all the time from people saying they'd been to the show and how fantastic it was, and why isn't there more of this? Why don't we see more of what's going on? And you know, and complimented me on my honesty, because when I write these little pieces to accompany the pictures, I'm pretty frank. I tell them what I really think. But it went down so well, you know. And it travelled, I think it went to 6 or 7 venues in 18 months. And that's probably, I think, will lead to other things, you know. I mean, everything takes time. I mean, the county council have already said, in fact, I'm planning now to do it because the war exhibition was such a success. I'm now doing an exhibition of my what I call my ordinary work, my civilian work, my pretty stuff. I'm doing an exhibition with them opening in September of my landscape work, because they think the contrast between the two might be quite interesting for people to see the other side of the coin, you know. I'm not sure how many war artists paint other things. I don't know. I mean, they did in the past. Now I'm not. I don't know, because I don't talk to war artists, you know.
How do you think your war art relates to your, should I say, normal art?
Yeah, my peaceful stuff.
Doesn't seem the right word.
Pastoral or whatever.
Yes.
It's not peaceful when I'm painting it, but the end result seems to be peaceful. But how does it relate? I view it as it's the same job. There's no difference in the job at all. The techniques are the same. The execution's the same. The mood's different. Subject matter's different. So it's the mood as much as anything, I suppose, that is the difference. I'm probably quite often working with a different palette when I'm war painting to when I'm doing landscape. And one feeds off the other. That's I mean, the benefit I have found, the benefit to my landscape work is that my war work has pushed me and pushed me and pushed me to tackle things that I didn't think I was capable of. The war work has taught me to be more adventurous in my compositions and my subject matter, and to push my painting technique an awful lot further. I mean, I'm pushing watercolour quite hard these days, and I'm the traditional English watercolour that you read in magazines about, and you see television watercolourists producing, you know. The traditional English watercolour seems to be something that you can knock out in half an hour, you know, it's spontaneity and all this stuff, you know, whereas I've slowed watercolour right down, so it takes me a week to paint a watercolour. It may not have the spontaneity of the half hour painting, but in a week I can put an awful lot into a watercolour and it can still sing at the end of the day, you know. So that's the benefit, really. The biggest benefit is that I've pushed the technique very hard, I'm using transparent colour, but I'm also using opaque colour. So I'm using watercolour like gouache on the same painting. I'm using more brushes, more variety of brushes. If I'm working with smaller brushes, that's quite interesting. Actually, I don't even just realise that. I paint with much smaller brushes than I used to. I take a lot longer to cover the ground than I used to because I'm using smaller brushes. My palette's broadened out a lot. I use a lot more colours. And my brush work is a lot more varied as well. And I'm using sandpaper sometimes to get textures and do a lot more scraping out with a scalpel. And so my overall technique it's improved hugely, you know.
Yes, you don't normally think of sandpapering and a scalpel.
No,
watercolour.
No, you don't. No. Turner used to use a scalpel, mind you. Well, he used to use his thumbnail, but he used it as a scalpel to you know, carve into the paintwork. The other thing, the war work has given me a lot more confidence. In fact, that may be the biggest benefit of all, actually.
Because you're confident enough to experiment.
Yeah, yeah. And it's also given me the confidence to talk to people as well, because I've got something to talk about. And that's quite interesting, because it's back to this thing. I have landscape painting as a landscape painting. You know, it's a pretty sunset or a nice tree, when you want to say something, you know.
I can imagine you would get a lot of questions. You know, for instance, looking at your two gods in Pristina, or, you know, Kosovo, at least, I forget. Was it Pristina?
Podievo,
yes. You know, people would say, well, where was this?
Yes.
Why were they there?
That's right. Pictures ask questions, and then that gives you the opportunity to explain, doesn't it?
Yes.
But that doesn't often happen with a landscape painting, does it?
No, it would be where was.
Well, not my landscape paintings, anyway.
No, I can see that.
Yeah.
Who is this man?
Yes.
Why is he bandaged up? And, yes.
So you can engage the public.
Yes.
With this sort of work. You can get them on board.
Yes. It's lovely that, you know, talking of recognition, that you're getting local
yes,
recognition,
yes.
As well as, you know, you're obviously international now, as well as nationally.
Yes, yes.
But sometimes people are not always appreciated by their locality.
No, no, they're not.
And, you know, it seems that you are known very well known. That's lovely.
Yeah, I quite enjoy that.
Well, Gordon, I think you've had enough for one day.
I think I have as well.
Thank you very much. And that would be the end of Reel 7.